Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Clear, hold, and build. Right now in southern Afghanistan, General Stanley McChrystal's counterinsurgency strategy is in action. Some 15,000 U.S. and allied troops, more than half of them Afghan, are working to secure the Taliban stronghold of Marja. Behind them comes an Afghan government. Success or failure could write the future of this region. This hour on Point, the troop surge in Afghanistan and the new U.S. strategy's first big test. You can join the conversation. What's at stake in the battle for Marja? Are you seeing signs of progress? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first this hour from Kabul, Afghanistan, is Rod Nordland, foreign correspondent for The New York Times. Rod, thanks for joining us. Nice to have you.
Thanks, Jim.
We're in day five of this surge in Afghanistan. Would you describe for us the progress so far?
Well, there continues to be sporadic fighting in Marja, sniping. They're still facing a problem removing the apparently enormous number of mines and improvised explosive devices. But there isn't a lot of set-to fighting. And each day the activity has been a little bit less than the day before overall, with some pockets of excitement still.
So would you say that U.S. soldiers are encountering less resistance than expected?
No, I think they hoped to encounter very little resistance, and I think they're encountering about what they expected, a fairly small number of diehards who've stayed behind and mostly kind of harassing fire, and then lots of booby traps and so on. And they gave, you know, plenty of notice that they were going into Marja just to try to encourage the Taliban to leave the area so that they could reduce the number of civilian casualties in a fairly heavily populated area with 80,000 people.
You mentioned the civilian casualties. There's a story by the Associated Press this morning that says that Taliban fighters are using civilians as human shields, that insurgents are firing at troops from inside or next to compounds where soldiers can very clearly see women and children on the roof or in windows. An Afghan commander is quoted as saying that militants are trying to get troops to fire on them and kill the civilians. As you well know, part of the goal of this offensive is to prioritize civilians on the ground. How are we doing so far?
Well, I think there also have been numerous instances because of that. I think they're quite aware of that, and it's this tactic that Taliban has consistently used, and it's a feature of this kind of conflict. And they are being very careful to try to hold their fire in those cases when they see that happening. There have been a number of accounts of instances where they didn't fire back for fear of hurting civilians. Now, we do have on Sunday, there was a very dramatic case where 12 people were killed when a rocket was fired into the building, apparently by mistake, according to our reporter who was at the scene at the time.
So the U.S., NATO, and Afghan forces have been broadcasting this attack on Marja weeks ahead of time, Rod, hoping that civilians and the Taliban resistance would leave. Are they broadcasting the plan after Marja? I mean, is the U.S. at a stage where they're thinking about what's next?
Yeah, they didn't try to encourage civilians to leave, really. They encouraged them to stay in their homes and off the streets once the fighting started. They hoped that most of the Taliban would leave, and most of them have left, from all accounts. The numbers are nowhere near the 1,000 or more fighters that were there last year. And they've also announced what they plan to do next, which is roll in what they call a government in a box, ready to go with services, schools, health clinics, and government facilities and so on, and try to set that up as quickly as possible and give people in Marja the sense that they're better off in the hands of their own government than controlled by the Taliban.
Well, Rod Nordland, I appreciate your time today. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Rod Nordland is a foreign correspondent for The New York Times. He joined us from Kabul. Joining me now from Monterey, California, is Kalev Sepp, assistant professor of defense analysis at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School and a retired Army lieutenant colonel and a special forces officer. From 2007 to 2009, he served as deputy assistant secretary of defense for special operations capabilities, helping to oversee global counterterrorism policy. Kalev Sepp, welcome back to On Point. Nice to have you.
Hello, Jane. Good to be here.
Thank you. And joining us from Washington is Peter Bergen. He's a longtime journalist and senior fellow at the New America Foundation, where he co-directs the Counterterrorism Strategy Initiative. He's also editor of the AFPAC channel at foreignpolicy.com and author of The Osama Bin Laden I Know, an oral history of Al-Qaeda's leader. Peter Bergen, it's great to have you back. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you. Peter, I'll begin with you. Explain the importance of securing Marja.
Well, I just want to step back a minute and say, what's the point of being in Helmand at all? And I have some. I was in Helmand in September, and obviously the Marines are doing a great job on many levels. But I sort of question the whole notion of having this very large effort in Helmand when really the center of gravity of the Taliban is in Kandahar. This is a bit like, you know, attacking Austria to try and end World War II when the center of gravity of the Nazis is not Austria but Germany. You know, Kandahar is where the Taliban was founded in 1994. It is where most of the leadership is from. It is the largest city in southern Afghanistan. It is the traditional capital, the Pashtuns. By an order of magnitude, it is more important than Helmand, which is not to say that Helmand is unimportant. Certainly, it's a province that, of all the provinces in Afghanistan, by a calculation of the Afghan National Army last year, it's the one that was either mostly controlled or at high risk for Taliban attacks. Of the 34 provinces, Helmand was kind of the most Taliban controlled in a sense. And of course, it's also the Taliban bank, because if Helmand were a country, it would be the source of the world's, the vast majority of the world's opium and heroin. But, you know, that being said, what's going on in Marja is a tactical battle. It's not a strategic battle by any stretch of the imagination, which is not to say that it's not worth doing. But I think there are much more important objectives. And now, you know, so clearly the U.S. military is aware that Kandahar is the center of gravity. But I think the reason that we're in Helmand is partly to do with the fact that decisions were made back in 2008 about Helmand. And once these decisions are made, the U.S. military being the kind of organization it is, it's very, very hard to sort of roll those decisions back. And I think it might have been smarter to focus on Kandahar from the beginning, because at the end of the day, that's where the Taliban is headquartered. That's their center of gravity.
Caleb Sepp, do you agree? Are we in the wrong place? Should we be focusing more on Kandahar?
Well, Peter's absolutely correct about Kandahar being the center of the Taliban movement, and it's certainly the Taliban's focus. But there may be some advantages to starting this kind of operation in Helmand, and fully recognizing what Peter says about, you know, that how decisions are made and plans put in motion and an organization as big as the Army and NATO, it's sometimes hard to reverse. But there's a doctrinal term called confidence target, and this is the largest operation that's been conducted since the initial operations in Afghanistan in 2001 and 2002, and it's also the largest employment in this way of Afghan troops. And it may be a much better proving ground for them to go up against, what is simply an easier target with less resistance, to begin to work out their own command and control functions and give these new units in the Afghan army the confidence that they can take on the enemy.
So we are in Marja, Peter Bergen. I continue to read that Marja is intended to serve as a prototype for this new type of military operation. What does that mean? What are the key tactics of this counterinsurgency operation?
Well, I think it's useful to contrast the tactics in this operation with the ones that preceded them, because that really explains what's different and what's improved, or what seems to be improved. You know, in the NATO had a phrase about anybody you talk to in NATO describing operations in southern Afghanistan the last several years would talk about mowing the lawn. And what does mowing the lawn mean? Mowing the lawn was basically the way these operations used to take place, which is you go in, you attack the Taliban, you don't really hold the area, you draw back, and then the next year you come in and you mow the lawn again because the Taliban are back. Now, the idea this time is to go in and never have to mow the lawn again, because you've got the government in the box that Rod Nordland mentioned. You've got the Afghan police, the Afghan army. in sufficient numbers to go in and hold the area. Because, Caleb knows this far better than I do, but absolutely the worst thing you can do in any kind of insurgency is to go in, clear an area, and then not hold it, because then you've left everybody involved who was sort of on your side subject to Taliban reprisal. Mm-hmm. So, and General McChrystal has said this repeatedly, absolutely the worst thing you can do is sort of clear areas and then not really hold them. It's better not to do the operation at all if you're going to do that. So, clearly there have been a lot of lessons learned, and some of them are from, in a sense, learning from Iraq. And a lot of this is simply common sense. You can't leave people hanging out to dry. When we were in Helmand, I was in Helmand with CNN in September. We had a quite interesting discussion with a tribal elder in some village, and the U.S. Marine Lieutenant Colonel we were with was talking to the tribal elder and saying, kind of essentially, are you happy that we're here? And the guy said, I don't really – he essentially said, the Taliban are strong. The U.S. military is strong. We're very weak. Kind of, we don't care. all we want is sort of it's sort of immaterial to us in a sense who controls the area, as long as they continue to control it and don't leave us in the situation where we're left high and dry. And interestingly, the lieutenant colonel, when pressed on how long will you be here by the local Afghans, he had to be pretty straightforward, which is, I cannot guarantee that we'll be here for forever. We know that there is a political domestic time. A clock that is ticking in the United States, and this is not forever. And so, fence sitting is part of life in Afghanistan. And well, if I was a tribal elder of a certain age, I would still be hedging my bets.
Clear as many cop houses as possible and push up.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the big push into the city of Marja in the Taliban's heartland. You're listening to Sound of U.S. Marines in Marja over the weekend discussing targets and firing weapons as they target suspected Taliban positions. At a press conference in Lashkar Gah on Monday, General McChrystal, the top NATO commander in Afghanistan, said his orders are very clear.
When President Karzai approved the conduct of this operation, he gave us some very specific guidance, and that guidance was to continue to protect the people of Afghanistan.
Peter Bergen is with us this hour. He's senior fellow at the New America Foundation, which he co-directs, where he co-directs the Counterterrorism Strategy Initiative. Khalif Sepp is also with us. He's a retired lieutenant colonel and a counterterrorism expert who teaches defense analysis at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School. I want to get to this point about political component to success in Afghanistan, because there's been a lot of talk about reintegration and reconciliation with the Taliban, even enlisting Taliban members to join the new government. Are there reconcilable leaders within the Taliban, Khalif Sepp?
This is one of the key points of discussion inside the Afghan government. And the reconciliation effort is—it's recognized that it has to be led by President Karzai. The Taliban have shown themselves to be pragmatic about certain things over time. When they were in control of the country after the Soviet-Afghan War, several years afterwards, when they succeeded in their internal civil war, they shut down opium production. They simply declared, this part of their doctrine that this was, this was against their particular ideology. Now, as a function of needing the revenues, as Peter, very aptly pointed out, that they needed the revenues from opium growing and trafficking, they've embraced it. And so it would be an indication that there would be leaders among the Taliban that would be able to read the cards at some point if they saw that that things were going in the direction of the newly elected Afghan government and their NATO supporters, and they could be reasoned with.
Besides trying to convince the lower level Taliban, Peter Bergen, to come around the reintegration of the Taliban, are we engaging it at higher levels, and who is conducting those operations?
Well, as Caleb pointed out, it's really an Afghan government function. There's sort of the kiss of death problem with the United States. There's you know, the Taliban have repeatedly said one of the preconditions of any negotiation is the withdrawal of international forces. So obviously, you know, the United States has some role to play at the lower levels because individual commanders have something called SERP, which is Commander's Emergency Response funding, which means that they have, you know, small amounts of discretionary funds that they can use to you know, bribe people away from the Taliban or pay them to do projects so they're not part of the Taliban. And there's money in the new defense budget specifically for this purpose to increase that money specifically for bribing away lower members of the Taliban. But at the upper levels of the Taliban, you know, you've had talking about the Taliban is difficult because there are Gulbuddin Hekmatyar is one Taliban leader who might be tempted to come in from the cold. He's not a very effective military leader, but there's been reports of him doing a deal with the Afghan government that seem plausible. While he's militarily insignificant, it's psychologically would be significant for a somewhat important Taliban leader to come in from the cold. You know, there were others like Mullah Omar and of course, Mullah Berader, who was just captured in mm-hmm. Pakistan. You know, they tended, you know, there have been a lot of mixed signals from them. Mullah Omar, for instance, has said, you know, we won't tolerate the use of Afghanistan for attacks against other countries. He said that several months ago, which is a promising thing. But he also, by the way, he said that before 9/11. So, you know, one wonders how sincere those comments are and to what extent they're just sort of governed by politics. And Mullah Omar, by the way, has had, more than 8 years now to say, I think Al-Qaeda is a bad idea. I think Osama bin Laden is a bad guy. You know, he's bad for us. He's bad for Afghanistan. He destroyed our regime. What he did was against Islam, and he's never said any of those things, and nor indeed has anybody, any senior leader of the Taliban. And the Saudis, who play a very important role in all this, because at the end of the day, if there is some sort of deal, part of it will probably involve exile in Saudi Arabia for senior Taliban leaders. And also the Saudis are seen as sort of an honest broker in this. They don't want to be part of a deal where Al-Qaeda is not rejected by the Taliban, because after all, Al-Qaeda's main goal is regime change in Saudi Arabia and getting rid of the Saudi royal family. So needless to say, there are a lot of moving parts to all this. Yes. There seems to be some movement. The British and the Japanese have said that they'll put up money for reintegration, and there does seem to be some movement. But I'm basically skeptical at the grand level, the grand strategy level, because, you know, Mullah Omar is not Henry Kissinger, and when it came down to it, he was prepared to lose everything on this point of principle about Osama bin Laden. He doesn't seem to be the sort of guy that you can easily negotiate with.
Let me ask you both about the capture of the Afghan Taliban second in command last week. First, here's some sound from an interview with Sky News with the Afghan Interior Minister talking about how he appreciated the effort and the help in that capture.
This shows cooperation from Pakistan with the international community and Afghanistan, and we welcome this. This has been what we've been asking for over the past 8 years.
Khalif Sepp, does this capture suggest that Pakistan perhaps has had somewhat of a change of heart, that they might indeed be ready to partner with the U.S. against terrorism in a more significant way?
Jane, there's always been a positive partnership within certain elements of the Pakistani government and military with some U.S. Organizations and agencies. Even now there's a very, very small number of U.S. military advisors that are working inside the country with the Pakistani Special Forces and the American Central Intelligence Agency, if journalistic reports are to be believed, and they seem credible. Has always had some connectivity with the Pakistani intelligence services. So this isn't a sea change that I think that we're seeing here. Although there's a number of positive indicators that the Pakistanis are recognizing the threat that the Taliban, both the Afghan Taliban and their own Taliban, the Pakistani Taliban, posed to their government and the stability in their country. At the same time, this is very slow in coming. Mm.
Peter Bergen, what do you think? Pakistan has been a safe haven for the Taliban, as you well know, for a long time. Do you see that changing?
I do. I mean, the Taliban have made a major strategic error, which is they've attacked where they live. I mean, it's a very basic strategic error, and they there's been no 9/11 moment to get no 9/11 moment in Pakistan. But if you take together the assassination of Benazir Bhutto at that time, the most popular politician in Pakistan, attacks on visiting cricket teams, you know, killings of literally hundreds and hundreds of Pakistani policemen, soldiers, thousands of civilians by the Taliban, attacks, by the way, on GHQ, which is the Pakistanis' equivalent of the Pentagon, by the Taliban. You know, the Taliban, if you were to construct a set of operations more likely to kind of irritate and anger the Pakistani military, including attacking mosques where senior Pakistani soldiers worship in Rawalpindi, which is their garrison headquarters, mm-hmm. you know, you'd come up with something what the Taliban's actually done. So the Taliban, I think there has been a sea change. I mean, Caleb's absolutely right that there's been a long history of cooperation, but a lot of it was, I think, cooperation that certainly the Pakistani public felt, well, we're doing this because the Americans want us to. Now, the big difference between the operations that we've seen in Swat earlier last year and also in southern Waziristan late last year is that these operations are done with the support of at least half the Pakistani public. Mm-hmm. These operations were not seen as, well, we're just doing this because the Americans are telling us to do these operations. Increasingly, they're seen as done because of Pakistani self-interest, not only by the Pakistani elite, but also by the Pakistani public. And the fact that they're willing to, you know, basically arrest Mullah Baradar, I think, is a pretty big deal because it changes all the calculations of the Afghan Taliban, who until 2 days ago or several days ago basically said, well, we have a safe haven in Pakistan, so we don't really have to worry. Now their safe haven has disappeared. Mm. And I think that has a big effect on how you approach negotiations, how you approach are we winning? Because, you know, in any counterinsurgency, if you have a safe haven, you know, you can basically you can guarantee that you can continue the struggle
right.
for an indefinite period. Without a safe haven, suddenly it looks a lot more like a hammer and an anvil on either side of the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan, a phrase that we've heard, you know, many, many years in the past, people are talking about that. There was never really a hammer or never really an anvil. Now there really is perhaps an anvil, and there certainly is a hammer with the large-scale American increase in Afghanistan.
Peter Bergen, Khalif Sepp, let me get some callers into this conversation. First from Fort Drum, New York, Kimo is on the line. I'm glad that you called, Kimo. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. I'm an infantry battalion commander at Fort Drum, New York. I've just returned from a year in Afghanistan. I just wanted to call and comment that Mr. Bergen's and Dr. Sepp's analysis of the current situation is really kind of spot on from my perspective. Now, I wasn't in the South. I was my battalion and my task force. We were in Wardak province, 30 kilometers south of Kabul. So every district, every province, every region is different. But the characterization of the Marja operation that you were currently discussing seems to me, as Dr. Sepp, I believe Dr. Sepp said, as a confidence target.
Mm-hmm.
That seems almost exactly right. Taking away that safe haven, having the with the surge, the extra troops, more troops going into an area, and then setting up good governance right behind security.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly the approach that we need there.
So, Kimo, as a battalion commander on the ground in Afghanistan, how would you measure success there, measure victory? What are the clear goals to your mind, the clear metrics about success?
Well, the success is really not, as we look back at counterinsurgency, it's not about the number of insurgents killed or the number of targets hit. It's the ability to, in the big picture, to stand up a government that the Afghan people will be proud of, will want to buy into, right. And a government that actually, does what governments do, which is care for their people, something mm-hmm. they don't have.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the major root causes of stability in my mind, is that does not exist, or did not exist in my last year there, and what we worked constantly to create. Mm-hmm. But security is the first part of that. Security is the egg before the chicken in this fight.
Kimo, thank you very much for your call, and thank you for your service, sir. Good luck to you. Let's get another call here from Mike. He's calling from Boston. Mike, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Go ahead.
Well, two things. One, I want to echo the previous caller on the good governance part. There is a important aspect of this that is often overlooked from counterinsurgency, and that is that as far as good governance, there are a lot of actors on the stage in Afghanistan, and perhaps more than we saw in Iraq or we would see in other places like Colombia. So I caution folks about talking about either the Taliban or the government, because there are a large number of disparate Taliban entities who will, if they can be reconciled or can be dealt with, will be dealt with in different fashions. And that also really applies to the government, too. The province-to-province differences would be as if you were in the United States trying to deal with 50 state governors and territorial governors in the absence of a federal government. Karzai is not called the mayor of Kabul for nothing, and it's a fact that a number of those provincial governments are run by, with, and really for bad actors, which complicates our problem substantially. So there isn't one government or one Taliban to deal with, and I really question whether or not characterizing somebody as the second in command of the Afghan Taliban is accurate in any meaningful sense other than a symbolic one.
It's a good point, Mike. Thank you. I see on the screen here you just got back from Afghanistan with the Air Force. Thank you, sir, for your service and for your call today. Khalif Sepp, Mike's saying we should be cautious about talking about the Taliban as a unified group. There are a variety of different Taliban organizations, no?
Well, Mike is absolutely right, and Peter's written and talked about this before as well. There's one of the intelligence reports I saw indicate that there were 184 distinct Taliban groups operating just inside Afghanistan. This isn't a communist style top down lockstep doctrinaire kind of organization. Where everybody follows, you know, the leader's dictates, and when we've eliminated leaders before, there's been some temporary disruptions inside these organizations, but nobody is well. There's some optimism with the particularly with the capture of Mullah Baradar in Pakistan. It's fortunate, and it's part of the realistic view of the Taliban that nobody is using terms like we've broken their back or this is the beginning of the end. Mm.
Peter Bergen, we heard Kimo talk about good governance, Mike, as well. Do the Afghans trust the government? I mean, will they respect the so-called government in a box that General McChrystal intends to roll in? What do you think?
You know, they'll respect it if it brings security. Otherwise, the rest is just sort of, you know, details. There's quite a lot. There was an interesting BBC poll which came out several weeks ago, and it asked a very standard polling question, which is, you know, what is your principal concern? And 32% of Afghans said my principal concern is security. Only 4% said corruption. And we hear a lot about Afghan corruption and how screwed up the government is, and that's, you know, partially true. But this is not a country with a great history of, you know, really functional government. If you, you know, take a Soviet invasion and the communist regime that came with it, followed by the warlords who replaced the communists, followed by the Taliban, you know, these are about as dysfunctional a set of governments you can imagine. So, you know, Afghans, I think, are really looking for something very simple, which is essentially security. We haven't been providing that for a very long time. The reason the Taliban came to power in the first place is the only public good they really offered was security, which is, after all, the first public good. And, you know, I think that the new plan does have a chance. You know, if you asked Jane, what would you be looking for, you know, as sort of a standard for success, I believe, with Kimo, when you asked him that question. And, you know, one benchmark I'd be looking at is, can you drive from Kabul to Kandahar along the highway, which is the most important road in the country, both economically and politically, without being kidnapped or shot at? Which, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, that would have not been a question that one asked. And now, of course, it's a problem. So, you know, if we can secure the key roads, secure some of the key cities, then you're beginning to look at a much more improved situation.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the big military offensive into the city of Marja in the Taliban heartland. That's a sound of military aircraft taking off over the weekend as part of that offensive. Khalif Sepp is with us. He's a former Special Forces officer who now teaches defense analysis at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School. And Peter Bergen is also with us. He's a longtime journalist and co-director of the Counterterrorism Strategy Initiative at the New America Foundation. I've got a lot of calls lined up. Let's go to them right now. First in Acton, Massachusetts, Mark is waiting on the line. Welcome to the program, Mark.
Hello, Jane.
Hi.
On Sunday, Vice President Cheney said he agreed with President Obama's Afghan strategy, but wishes he'd gotten to it sooner, which I thought was odd considering that Cheney was in office for the previous 8 years. And it reminded me of what Secretary Bob Gates said last year. He said that the strategy that President Obama put forward last year was the first real strategy we've had for Afghanistan since the early 80s. And that during his tenure as Bush's Secretary of Defense, we were fighting a holding action. We were too stretched to do more. My question for your guests is, do you agree with Secretary Gates? And if you do, how much more dangerous and precarious is our position in Afghanistan and Pakistan as a result of being diverted to go looking for non-existent weapons of mass destruction in Iraq?
Mark, thank you. Khalif Sepp, you first.
This is going to be answered by historians. I mean, there's already been a number of comments about you know, how this might have played out, but there's a great many what ifs involved in that. But I very much appreciate Mark's insight into this. What his citing Secretary Gates though is the real point about, you know, it brings us to where we are now, which is that Afghanistan was seen as a holding action while the much more critical campaign in Iraq was resolved. And now the, you know, resources and attention can be turned to Afghanistan.
Peter Bergen, what are your thoughts?
You know, I second what Khalif says. I mean, clearly, you know, Afghanistan was the least resourced post-World War II operation the United States has been involved in. According to a careful study by RAND, I think, you know, the United States spent something like 12 or 18 times more per capita in Bosnia and Kosovo. And you get what you pay for. We did it on the cheap. We are where we are. In a sense, it's pretty obvious that we could have done better. The Afghan army in 2003 consisted of 6,000 men. That's the size of a police force in an American city like Houston. Hardly the size, you know, Afghanistan's a country the size of Texas with very difficult topography. So, you know, Winston Churchill famously said the Americans will always, you know, do the right thing after they've exhausted every other possibility. And we are at that point. And I think that finally, we do have a plan that sort of makes sense, given the political constraints at home, the resources available. I mean, obviously, you know, if in an ideal world, you'd send 300,000 American soldiers to sort the problem out. That we don't live in that world. But given the resources constraints, and I think, by the way, the reason that the Obama administration spent 10 weeks deliberating this strategy was, this is an enormously complex problem. Some of the people in those meetings were not Afghanistan, Pakistan experts. There is a lot of moving parts to all this, and I actually think in the context of something this complex, a 10-week decision process is not actually that long.
Mm-hmm. Here's another call from Aurora, New York. John is on the line. Welcome to the program, John. Hello.
How are you doing?
Fine. Go ahead.
Right. As I recall, all of this conversation came about due to 9/11 and Osama bin Laden. And the game was to get him, and I hope still is. And what confuses me, and maybe your guests can answer, is why do we as a government or as a people ever think that by pouring all of this money, billions, trillions of dollars, and all of our loss of life into these two countries would ever get bin Laden? Because as I look at the monopoly board, he's the goose that laid the golden egg for them. So the more money we pour in there, it seems to me, why would they ever give him up?
John, thank you very much. Khalif Sepp, your response.
The question would be, I think, and I would really want to know Peter's view on this, is that, you know, what to do about bin Laden now? And a very good argument could be made that one of the things that we have to be careful for is actually that we that we don't kill him and make him a martyr. Mm-hmm. But he's also become, in his own way, very marginalized in what goes on now. You know, he's something of a symbol, but is not part of the ongoing campaigns the way that I think that we were, you know, would have been concerned that he might have been at this point.
Peter Bergen, Bin Laden somewhat marginalized now, and what to do about him moving forward?
You know, if von Stauffenberg had succeeded with the bomb underneath the conference room table on July 20th, 1944, succeeded in killing Hitler, World War II would have ended a year earlier. And I'm not comparing these two conflicts. They're very, very different. But what I am trying to say is that certain people change history, and it's very hard to think of somebody in the recent sort of modern era who more changed history personally than Bin Laden, because 9/11 really was his idea. It was something that he pushed against the opposition of some of his own even senior leaders. Mm. Certainly the Taliban would have been opposed if they'd knew that it was going to happen. Al-Qaeda was his creation, and people make a difference. And yes, he is symbolic, as Caleb pointed out, but symbols are important. And he does exercise some command and control over the global jihadi movement by virtue of these audio tapes that he constantly releases. For instance, he's recalled for reprisals against the Danish newspaper that did the cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad, as a result of which the Danish embassy was attacked in Pakistan in 2008 by an al-Qaeda suicide bomber. We've had a Somali man try and kill the Danish cartoonist involved in that cartoon just recently. And so, you know, he does, by virtue of commander's intent, which is an American military doctrine, meaning that, you know, not every al-Qaeda foot soldier or jihadi needs to know what Bin Laden, you know, needs personal direction from Bin Laden. He's already put out the commander's intent, which, you know, kill Westerners, kill Jews, kill Americans. And sometimes he also intervenes to make very specific suggestions, like, you know, attacking Danish targets. So I think it is important to find him. You know, finding him is not it's a very complex problem. You know, it took 15 years for the Israelis to find Eichmann after the Holocaust, not for a lack of trying. And Bin Laden is not making the kinds of errors that get you caught. No satellite phones, no cell phones. The people around him are not motivated by cash. Mm-hmm. He's a tough target. I mean, you know, he's just celebrated his he was born in February of 1957, so but actuarial tables suggest that he will be around for quite a lot longer. He's not necessarily going to die of natural causes.
Do you think he'll ultimately be captured? He'll ultimately be captured, Peter?
Yeah, by the law of averages, yes. I mean, I don't think he'll be captured, by the way. He'll be killed. You know, but, you know, he's going to make a mistake because people make mistakes. Whitey Bulger, you know, who our Boston listeners are very familiar with, you know, he's been the subject he's on the 10 most wanted list since 1999, allegedly committed 20 murders in the Boston area. He still hasn't been found. So, you know, but people do make mistakes because they're human, and eventually I think he will make a mistake that basically signals his position.
Let's go to Connecticut now. Franklin, Connecticut. Steve is on the line. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the program. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, how are you?
Hi. Well, go ahead.
One quick question, and then I'll let your guest answer. It sounds like we're finally on the right course in Afghanistan and Pakistan, but I would ask, do we believe that these efforts will definitely minimize and maybe end the construction of the extremist schools, the madrasas, and promote the building of schools like Dr. Greg Mortensen is building? Because over the long term, this is certainly what we want to accomplish, to minimize terrorism. Thank you.
That's an interesting point, Steve. Caleb Sepp, I'll let you respond. I was reading in the Wall Street Journal about a project in Sinjar, Afghanistan, a Taliban stronghold west of Kandahar, where American troops took last year, and they're allocating now $1 million for schools and other development projects. Is that the kind of strategy that we should be pursuing along Steve's point, Caleb?
The education is the key to all of this. I mean, the point about the caller is mentioning in terms of the you know, why are the madrasas important? It's because they're taking in young children, young boys. Of course, women are excluded in among the in the extremist ideologies, and teaching them this very distorted understanding of Islam from very early on. And then that's very, very hard to undo, to, you know, to deprogram them later. The you know, as the chemo had called from Fort Drum, and Mike from Boston probably know very, very well now, that, you know, this component, the education component of improving governance in Afghanistan and Pakistan, for that matter, is very important. But how it's done can be very difficult. Simply building a building and calling it a school in many places, you know, in Afghanistan, as we'd experienced in Iraq as well, these things became monuments to failure because we left these areas unsecured. The Taliban returned, blew up the buildings, killed or terrorized the teachers, and then just reestablished themselves. Mm. Morton, one of the successes to Mortensen's approach is that it's agreed on by the local populations to accept, you know, his approach and the building of schools, and it's done very, very much just by the local people. Mm.
Here's another call from Jenna in Plattsburgh, New York. Hi, Jenna. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, I'm a student at SUNY Plattsburgh. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering, because one of the main reasons for going into this war was, you know, the social, like saving the women, you know, mm-hmm. the social sanction of freeing them from the Taliban. So, and putting the Taliban back in the government, I mean, what is this going to mean for the women that have been oppressed for so long underneath their government previously?
Jenna, thank you. What about social justice, especially as it relates to women, Peter Bergen?
Well, I think that's a very good point. And, you know, absent from President Obama's speech at West Point on December 1st was any mention of the Taliban's, you know, absolutely antediluvian treatment of women and their social policies in general, which was a strange omission. You know, the whole idea of a moderate Taliban seems to me almost oxymoronic. You know, is that the Taliban guy who lets women go to school once a week? I understand the impulse to try and say that there is a moderate Taliban. I think there are people that are more, you know, willing to engage. I think the caller has made a very, very, very good point, because the whole Taliban project really revolved around excluding women from jobs and from schools. That was almost one of the central doctrines that they had. And, you know, clearly, you know, one of the great achievements of the Afghan kind of political economy right now is you've got, you know, a quarter of the members of parliament are women. They may not have as much clout as some of the members of parliament that are there, but you know, there is a sort of way of representing women's views politically in the Afghan parliament. Would the Taliban turn around and say, well, we're going to want to reduce that? And my guess is that they would.
Khalif Sepp, I have a question for you about the cost of this ongoing offensive, this surge in Afghanistan, in terms of money and troops. And if you think the Obama administration is prepared to stay with this as costs increase, and especially if casualties begin to mount, I mean, what's the public stomach for an extended campaign in Afghanistan?
Well, that is the key question, because all of this, you know, depends on on what Americans think. And the indications are that they're tired of this war, and as a number of your callers have indicated, there's an underlying question of, you know, what's this all for, and when are we going to see the kind of results that we've, you know, made these investments for, both in blood and treasure. Mm-hmm. The key will be next year to see if the effort that's being put into growing the Afghan National Army and the Afghan National Police, essentially doubling both of those in size from their current, they're both about 90, depending how you count, 90 or 100,000 each in those organizations. Can the effort that's being put into training them and then providing them advisors produce competent security forces that will embrace this idea of protecting their own people, which is very difficult given the disparate ethnic makeup of Afghanistan, and that is in the past has resulted in tribal feuding and civil war.
And Peter Bergen, with only about a minute left here, is it reasonable and realistic to think that President Obama's July 2011 target date for U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan is feasible?
Well, it was very carefully, artfully worded, and it wasn't really, the beginning of withdrawal, conditions-based. I mean, conditions-based is you can drive a truck through that caveat. Right now, only one of the 34 provinces in Afghanistan is controlled by the Afghan army and police, and that's Kabul province. So the idea that suddenly 33 of them are going to be ready to be controlled by the Afghan army or police, by July 2011 is, that's a pipe dream.
Mm-hmm. Khalid Semp, I'll give you the last word here. Peter Bergen said his level of success or drawing clear goals for success in Afghanistan is being able to drive a car from Kabul to Kandahar without getting killed. I think those were your words, Peter. How would you describe success as you see it moving forward in Afghanistan?
One of the most hopeful things that happened during your show, Jane, was the call from Kimo and Mike, and these are military people, and they are speaking about how to conduct these operations, how to fight a counterinsurgency. In terms that only 5 years ago, a handful of experts, like Peter, as an example, would have been able to understand, and now this knowledge and this sense of the doctrine is widespread throughout the American Armed Forces, and that holds the biggest hope of making McChrystal's strategy and President Obama's plan for Afghanistan work.
Well, many thanks to my guests for a very thoughtful hour today. Peter Bergen, Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation and co-director of their Counterterrorism Strategy Initiative. Peter, thank you as always. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Jane.
Khalid Semp, Professor of Defense Analysis at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School and former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations Capabilities. Khalid, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Jane.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.